Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how air traffic controllers are handling their need to go to work without pay during the government shutdown.
And some legendary blues recordings were made right here in Phoenix.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Well, look, the people of America know that the Republicans are in charge of this government right now. They have the majority in the House, the majority in the Senate. Obviously, President Trump is in the White House. They control everything. This is their shutdown, not ours.
I spoke with Adelita last night, and she doesn't have keys to her office. She is unable to hire staffers, and she is unable to adequately represent her constituents. And that is absolutely outrageous.
We've not had a full session. She deserves to have all the pomp and circumstance that everybody else does. She deserves to have a full house of members and go down and do the speech and have her family and friends in the balcony. That hasn't been scheduled because we haven't had that session yet.
We have no screens in the TSA checkpoints, which is where the video was requested to be played. So we have no capability to play it. If we did have screens, though, technically it would be advertising, and our advertising policy prohibits political speech of any type in the airport.
Instead of giving us the records, they filed a lawsuit against us for asking for public records. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
And with me to talk about the continuing saga over a congressional swearing-in, controversy over a leaked group chat, and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. Jaime, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
And former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Jaime, let me start with you. We keep hearing about Congresswoman-elect Adelita Grijalva not becoming officially Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva. What do you make of this continuing saga, the fact that she keeps saying and Democrats keep saying, okay, she won, now the election has actually been certified, she should be sworn in, and House Speaker Mike Johnson saying, not quite yet?
Well, first off, I'm always surprised that you ask a question that doesn't get at the fact that politics actually happens in Washington, D.C.
I know.
But, you know, the speaker's retort has been that, well, wait a minute. You know, we're facing a little thing called a government shutdown. None of the Democrats are engaged to try and get it open. Every Republican has voted for that. So that's what the line is, and he's sticking to it. Whether or not, you know, Alita's ability to become a congresswoman officially makes any difference in all that travails. I think the speaker's just saying, look, if the Democrats are going to be doing this to us, then why should I go back and do something for the Democrats? And I think a lot of his caucus members probably like the fact that he's doing that.
Yeah, Reginald, now that the election has been certified, Attorney General Chris Mays said this week that she might sue Mike Johnson if he doesn't swear her in or come up with a plan to swear her in the not-too-distant future. As Jaime said, I'm shocked that there's politics happening here.
Yeah, no, this is actually, I think, a pretty dangerous, a situation that we have here. Representative-elect Grijalva, she was certified. You know, the people spoke. She won over 70% of the votes in the race. Her duly elected constitutional right is to be sworn in and represent the people of her district. You have over 800,000 people who don't have a congresswoman. So at any time when you have, if political games have the ability to override the will of the people, that's an issue, right? You know, Speaker Johnson, his job is temporary. You know, the Constitution, that's long lasting. That's history. That's forever. He doesn't get to decide whether or not the people of Arizona have the ability to have a representative. And also, it's putting a lot of people's, you know, livelihoods in jeopardy. You know, if you're a staffer, you know, you're ready to get the work, you're not getting a paycheck. Do you live, you know, do you have a place to stay? I mean, this is really difficult.
Jaime, do you buy into the narrative that a lot of the Democrats are saying, including Congresswoman like Grijalva, that the real reason that Mike Johnson is not swearing her in is because she would be the final vote on the discharge petition to release the Epstein files?
The signature on the petition,
yeah,
to get that moving. Well, you know, the Epstein issue, I'm not so sure if it resonates as much anymore. But again, there's politics going on here. And that's a great talking point that the Democrats are throwing out there, and they're scoring political points with it. So they continue to really push that narrative. But again, you know, you have all these lawsuits that are going on. Attorney General Mays is and the question is also asked, who hasn't she sued? She's had more lawsuits. I think she's up to like 27 now or something. So these kinds of things always get played out in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I would agree that constitutionally that's the thing that people should focus on, that we should try and honor, you know, our democratic structures as much as possible. But again, you know, hopefully we can get through this budget mess too. Even if she was able to bring on staff, they still couldn't get paid because the government shut down. So we just got to get through that.
So, Reginald, obviously the reason that Mike Johnson is saying, as Jaime alluded, that he's not swearing her in is that the government is shut down and Democrats need in the Senate need to vote to reopen the government. Do you see an end to this shutdown? I mean, it doesn't really seem like there's a whole lot of discussion happening, negotiations happening on a way to potentially get the sides together to reopen the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that Speaker Johnson gave is just not the reality. I mean, you know, he could, you know, he has the ability to bring the House into session and to swear in Grijalva, and that has absolutely nothing to do with what the United States Senate, which is a whole separate body, is negotiating on. You know, the House, they've already, you know, passed, you know, their continuing resolution, which, you know, Democrats rightfully, you know, I feel like they have a great case to fight back. I mean, you have families who are going to have their insurance premiums tripled. I mean, when you look at insurance costs right now, that is a significant deal. And to tell everyday voters, like, your insurance costs could potentially triple, I think that's something that people, you know, want Democrats to fight for. And that is totally separate from Representative Grijalva being sworn in. The negotiation is with the U.S. Senate and the parties that be, and it has nothing to do with her being able to, you know, be sworn in.
Jaime, we know that the Trump administration and many Republicans in Congress and beyond are blaming Democrats, especially in the Senate, for the shutdown. We heard that specifically from Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem this week. There was a video, you know, if you walk through like Sky Harbor, when you get to TSA, usually the DHS secretary is on there explaining, like, here's what TSA is doing. Here's right. Why you can't have like a giant water bottle coming through TSA full of liquid with you. But this video specifically blames Democrats for the shutdown and any inconvenience that travelers might have. Sky Harbor says, we're not playing that. A number of other airports.
Gateway also.
Gateway, yeah. Tucson, we heard somebody from Tucson Airport saying, we don't have screens at TSA, but even if we did, we wouldn't play this. I'm curious what you make of the fact that they recorded this whole new video specifically blaming Democrats, you know, in what is normally just sort of an informational kind of video.
Well, again,
I know politics, you know, at play here.
You got to understand that both sides are trying to create a narrative that at the end of the day gets the American public to be very aggressive against either political party,
the other side.
And so right now, the Democrats have talking about health care. They're saying this is our number one issue. We will not do a continuing resolution. Even when in the past, as we all know, Chuck Schumer has said we should do these continuing resolutions and not deal with these other issues until that gets done. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hypocritical of what's being talked about now versus what they've talked about in the past. Trump administration, yeah, doing a video saying, well, play this in every airport and I'm going to be there telling you that the Democrats are the problem for this whole thing. That's a little silly. I wouldn't argue that. And I can see why a lot of airports, especially Sky Harbor, saying, well, wait a minute, this is not about the politics. We just don't want any politics involved. And I think if you were to do that, I can imagine what kinds of things in the future might be done. It's crazy what – if that were a precedent, when the Democrats come back in power, you know, a lot of people aren't going to want to hear what they have to say too.
Do you think it's good politics for the Trump administration to be trying to do this?
I don't know if it's good politics, Mark, but it's politics. And I think that they're just hammering that message home that this is not – we have every single Republican that's voted for this to continue government, to get people back into work, make sure that everybody's getting what they need to get as far as their pay. So they're just continuing to pound that narrative. And I think it's starting to have some, at least in polling that I've seen, starting to have some resonance. But they're not going to get off that message anytime soon.
At least not at the at least not at Sky Harbor. I mean, Reginald, do you see it as good politics from the Trump administration to continue to try to hammer this narrative in literally any way they possibly can, any venue they can?
Yeah, I mean, I used the word dangerous before, and I would argue it is dangerous again. You know, obviously we know that there's a intersection between, you know, politics and government, but just imagine that. Anytime you walked into, you know, the Department of Transportation, or you know, you walk into, you know, any state agency, you have playing in that state agency political advertisements for whatever party is in control, whether it's at the state level, the local level, the federal level. I mean, if we want to tone down, you know, the partisanship that we see in our country, the last thing that everyday voters want to do is walk into any government institution and have a video that's saying hooray for Republicans or hooray for Democrats. I think like this, I wouldn't say it's, you know, censorship them not playing it. I think it's common sense that they shouldn't do it. And the reality is that, you know, the public, I think this could actually come back to hurt the Trump administration or any administration that is trying to use the government resources to play political games.
Interesting. All right. That is Reginald Boulding. I'm also joined by Jaime Molera. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are former State House Minority Leader Reginald Boulding and former State School Superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. I mean, let me start with you with a story from Politico this week that exposed a group chat among a number of members of young Republicans across the country, mostly in New York, a couple of them here in Arizona, that had some pretty nasty things to say, some racist things, anti-Semitic things, sexist things, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We saw the Vice President, J.D. Vance, basically say, you know, these are kids who are, you know, saying stupid things as most kids do. It should be pointed out, though, that, you know, these are not kids. These are people in their 30s
adults,
who have, like,
right,
legit jobs, right, some of whom are elected office, you know, state officers in Vermont, I believe. So I'm curious, like, what you make of the fact that this existed, and it seemed as though the people involved knew that if it got out, they'd be in some trouble. But also the reaction to it is like, this is maybe not such a big deal.
I disagree with that, though, Mark, because I think that a lot of the organizations came out and said, you're not working for us anymore.
True.
Whether they're congressmen that have relieved staffers, Center for Arizona Policy just fired one of their staffers that was involved in this. You have organizations that say we're disbanding the Young Republicans because of that reason. So I don't think people have taken it lightly.
The vice president, though, seems to be not taking
point,
it heavily.
His point was a little bit different. He talked about how where was the moral outrage of the Democrats that are coming after Republicans when certain Democrats were talking about for the execution of certain congresspeople or congressional leaders. So I think that that was more of a different point that he was trying to make. But certainly criticizing these individuals for doing what they did is warranted. And certainly a lot of them losing their positions, I think, is warranted. We shouldn't countenance this kind of behavior. It's ugly. It's stupid. It's just something that I know the Republican Party is taking steps internally. Even the state director said, we don't want these kinds of people working for us.
Reginald, there are so many conversations and articles written about the need to, you know, quote unquote, tone down the rhetoric, turn down the temperature, you know, stop the vitriolic commentary. And yet it doesn't seem as though that's really happening. I mean, maybe it is. And, you know, cases like this are sort of isolated incidents. But we seem to keep hearing about people writing and texting and saying things like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is one where you have to have, you know, leaders who are willing to say, hey, this is wrong. They shouldn't have done it, you know, full stop and move on. Right. But what we consistently see and hear from a lot of leaders is, well, they did it, too. You know, it's not just us. It's you know, it's Democrats, too, or it's Republicans, too. Like, and this is what people are exhausted with. You know, they want to make sure that if you're a leader, if you see something that was said or was done that was immoral, that you can speak on it and you can say it full stop. I mean, I think this instance here really is a is an issue that I think that that Republicans are going to have to really, you know, make sure that it doesn't reinforce some stereotypes that people already believe about, you know, Republican Party, whether it's issues with diversity, inclusion, or image control, because those are, you know, extremism. That is what some folks, you know, associate with Republicans. And I think that this was enough of an issue that institutions said, hey, we need to distance ourselves, you know, from this. But I think at the end of the day, it was an issue. I think that the organizations that, you know, fired those individuals, distanced themselves. Yeah, absolutely. They did the right thing. And I think that now we have to really have leaders who are willing to say it wasn't right.
Jaime, I'm wondering if it says anything to you that the people involved in this group chat recognize that what they were saying shouldn't get out. Like, I think they're, I'm going to paraphrase, but basically, like, we're in a lot of trouble if this ever got out, if anybody saw what we were doing. And yet they still did it.
Right.
So I wonder, and this is not necessarily just a Republican issue or a Democratic issue, but just sort of in the world of politics that people recognize that, okay, we shouldn't say this, we shouldn't do it, but we're going to do it anyway.
Well, especially a lot of those young people, after witnessing what happened with Charlie Kirk, should have said, well, wait a minute, you know, let's take a step back and think about what we're saying and doing, because it leads to these kinds of horrible, disgusting things. And so, and it happens on both the left and the right. Mm-hmm. And I think there needs to be a recognition. And I'm pleased that a number of organizations, like I said, have stepped up and said, look, we're just not going to accept that. And if you were representing me as one of my staffers, you're not going to be there anymore. And so that does send a very powerful message, and I think it has sent a powerful message. But I think both sides need to realize, both sides of the aisle, that that kind of extremist rhetoric does lead to really ugly things. And we just need to say, nope, we're not gonna deal with that kind of stuff anymore.
Reginald, could this be, I hate to use the phrase inflection point, but could this be sort of an incident that maybe changes things a little bit, that gets people to recognize we just shouldn't be doing this or saying this or writing it or texting it or whatever?
No, I don't think it's going to be an inflection point. I wish it would be, right? You know, it's one of those things where you take two steps forward, three steps back. You have institutions, you have, you know, congressional leaders, you know, you have folks who are letting go of staff, and then you have the vice president say, you know, what he said. You know, I mean, it's like one of those things where we have to just you know, ask ourselves, you know, where is the end, right? I mean, like, the partisanship is literally at an all-time high. You think, you know, you had opportunities for these, you know, watershed moments where you could have brought the country back together and things that are happening, but it hasn't happened. So I'm not sure what, you know, what's going to be that inflection point. I don't think this is going to be it. But my hope is that, you know, we find a way to really have leaders who are willing to focus on that.
Okay. Guys, before we wrap up, I want to ask you about the third quarter campaign finance numbers in the governor's race. I'm just talking about the money on hand. Karen Taylor-Robeson, about $978,000. Andy Biggs, about $630,000. David Schweikert, since he got into the race recently, it hasn't filed yet. Governor Hobbs, almost $5.5 million. Jaime, obviously the GOP primary is going to be pretty heavily contested, potentially unpleasant for the people involved and maybe those watching it. Anything stand out to you about the numbers that we're seeing so far?
I think for Andy Biggs, a lot of people didn't think that he would have as much compared to Karen Taylor-Robeson. And the thing that I've always told folks about the Republican primary, what Biggs has going for him is going to be very powerful in that he has Turning Point, has indicated they're going to be all in for Congressman Biggs. And I think Turning Point's presence with everything that just happened is going to be very, very important. And then you combine that with Club for Growth, which is also a national organization with a lot of deep pockets. So that bodes well, I think, for Congressman Biggs, particularly if he's able to demonstrate he can raise money on his own. I think that adds a lot.
Well, you kind of wonder how much money, how much the actual candidate fundraising might matter in this primary, because you have Karen Taylor-Robeson obviously has a lot of personal money. And as you say, Andy Biggs has a lot of sort of institutional money that will come his way. Presumably David Schweikert will have outside money as well. Does that maybe make the individual campaign fundraising numbers less relevant here, do you think?
I do. I do, especially nowadays with the two organizations I mentioned, Turning Point and Club for Growth. They have enormous influence in the Republican Party. We know that.
Yeah.
I mean, Turning Point has been a very well-regarded. If you look at the turnouts that have occurred since the Kirk assassination, it's been massive. And all of those, by and large, are Republicans. And so they're going to be the ones in the Republican primaries. And I think that bodes well for Congressman Biggs. I really do.
Benjamin, what do you think? Last minute or so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, looking at the fundraising numbers of the individual candidates, I think it's nice because it gives us something to report on. But it's also the numbers that we don't see, you know, from these organizations that are going to definitely make the difference. But I do think from a candidate standpoint, it does show, do you have the organization in place in order to actually be competitive? Can you set yourself up for success so these organizations want to throw down for you?
Sort of an indicator of maybe other things relative to the campaign.
Absolutely.
Correct. Interesting. All right. Well, I'll have to leave it there. Reginald Boulding, Jaime Molera, thanks to you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Be here.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The ongoing federal government shutdown has led to flight delays at some airports across the country as air traffic controllers have called in sick. Their union is telling members not to do anything that would reflect badly on the profession. But as my next guest explains, not getting paid means some controllers cannot come to work. Joel Ortiz is the Western Pacific Regional Vice President for the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon and asked what he's hearing from his members.
There's a lot of concern, a lot of fear. I think concern is the biggest thing right now. We have a lot of controllers that are new into the agency that have been in the agency, you know, less than 4 or 5 years. When you haven't been in the agency that long, in some cases, they're not certified. In some cases, you know, they're starting off in the lower part of the pay bands that we have. They're starting their families. They maybe got their first home. And, you know, when you first start any career, you don't have a big savings readily available to rely upon for an undisclosed amount of time. You know, it would be one thing if they knew they were going to miss one paycheck, but we'll get that paycheck back to you 2 weeks later. They have no idea when they're going to get paid. And for example, those controllers that have children that are in childcare, some of them are having to miss work because the childcare provider isn't taking IOUs. Mm. And we're getting told we're going to get IOUs, but the phone company, the water company, the gas company, the mortgage company, the childcare providers, if you got to put gas in the car, that doesn't work on IOUs. You need to have money to pay for those things. And they're concerned about how long they're going to have to go without the certainty of knowing that they're going to get paid.
I'm wondering if the concern about pay has maybe even increased this week as, you know, your members miss their first paycheck.
It has. So they missed 2 days of that pay period. And for a lot of them, you know, that 2 days was a big difference. And I was at the Oklahoma City Academy yesterday talking to all the new controllers that are going to be graduating, you know, from the academy going into the field. Their fear is, as it was yesterday, they're only funded until October 27th. And then on October 27th, what ends up happening is they get sent home. So where they've gone through maybe half or three quarters of the academy and the curriculum, if there is no more funding for the academy, their training stops, they get sent home, and they get told probably in about 6 months that they can come back because all the class dates already have students lined up to go to them months in advance. So they're not going to bump the other students that are already scheduled to go to the academy for them. So their concern is they put in a reasonable amount of time at the academy to become an air traffic controller. It's going to stop. They're going to have to go home and they're going to have to start the process all over again.
And that's probably not all that helpful in an industry that is not, you know, overflowing with people doing this job, right? Like it's not like your staffing is where it really needs to be anyway, right?
That is correct. When we had that 35-day shutdown, you don't really know the impact it has until years later because the process to make an air traffic controller takes years. There is attrition that happens every step of the way, and you don't really know who would have been a certified controller at the end of those processes until you go through them. And when you stop 35 days worth of classes, you have a void in staffing that you should otherwise not have.
So I know that the union is encouraging its members not to, for example, call in sick or, you know, do any kind of action, you know, sort of as a protest to having to go into work and not get paid. But you also alluded to the fact that some members like have to take time off because they can't pay for childcare for that kind of thing right now. I'm wondering what you're seeing and what you're hearing from your members in terms of their ability and maybe to some extent even their desire to go to work while they know they're not going to get paid.
So it's definitely a distraction. Calling in sick deliberately to slow the system down or to cause delays or to cause, you know, cancellations. It's called a job action and that is illegal. So we remind them, like, even though you may want to do these things, we don't do these things. And, you know, what we don't want to do is for the flying public. You know, they rely on the air traffic controllers to be at work so they can get to point A to point B. We need to be reliable to the national airspace system so the flying public, you know, has the controllers there to rely on, to know that the professionals are going to show up every day. They're going to remain vigilant. They're going to do their jobs. But to your point, I mean, they got a partial paycheck last Friday, but on October 28th, when that next payday comes and it's $0, there are some people that are going to have to make decisions, not because they're bad employees, not because they willfully want to do something that's going to put their careers in jeopardy, but because if you don't have money to pay for gas, you don't have any more credit on the credit cards because you put the rent on the credit card, you put the gas on the credit card, you put the electricity on the credit card, you're going to run out of, you know, lines of credit to make it work. So that first $0 paycheck has a big impact on the controllers.
Well, so you mentioned earlier on how so many of your members are, you know, a few years into the job, which means that they were not around during the last shutdown. I wonder if it would help in some way if you had some percentage of air traffic controllers who had kind of been through this, and it doesn't make it any easier in the moment, but just sort of knowing that there will be an end to it and having been through that, like, I wonder if that's adding to sort of the concern and the anxiety among your members that they haven't been through this before.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I would say probably, and I'm guesstimating, but I'm in the ballpark. I would say 35% of our workforce was not around in 2019 for that shutdown. Mm. Fortunately or unfortunately, I've been in this role for a little while and I've been around through all five of the shutdowns as a controller. And to your point, they do inevitably eventually end, but this one just, it feels a little different than previous shutdowns.
How so?
The partisan politics seem to have a bigger role in this. And, you know, throughout the course of all the other shutdowns, you would feel, at least on a daily basis, there were conversations that were occurring. You know, generally speaking, it feels like both sides have kind of held the line and there's really no movement that's been made. And we're on the third week and I don't have any indication that this is close to ending.
Well, so you mentioned that you've been around for all of these and obviously, you know, you are a member of this community. Like, how are you doing not getting paid?
You know, I've been doing this for 25 years. So fortunately for me, I've had the ability to endure some of these shutdowns before, and it doesn't hurt me as it inevitably will, but I can go one or two paychecks and I'll be okay. But once the third and fourth come in, then you're wondering, when is it going to end? So I'm okay right now, but again, I've been a controller for 25 years.
Sure. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Joel Ortiz, Western Pacific Regional Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Joel, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, I appreciate the time.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Well, if you've ever tuned in to KJZZ on Sunday nights, you know our next guest this morning. Bob Corator is not just the host of Those Lowdown Blues right here on KJZZ. He's the owner of the Rhythm Room here in Phoenix. And if you didn't know it, an internationally renowned Grammy-nominated harmonica player. Now, I did a segment on the show not too long ago with a local music writer who had compiled a list of the 100 greatest songs recorded in Arizona. Number 87 on that list was Out on the Road by Jimmy Rogers, recorded by none other than Bob Corator when he came through town and played at Bob's Club. Apparently, that's something he does often. When great acts come through town to play the Rhythm Room, he books some recording time with them. And I wanted to hear more about that. So I asked Bob to come into the studio, not on a Sunday night, and talk to me more about it. But we began our conversation with his own lifelong obsession with the blues.
I heard blues and I just fell in love with it. I heard Muddy Waters on the radio.
You were young, right? Like what, 10, 11, something like that?
Well, 12.
There you go.
So, and I rode my bicycle into downtown Wilmette, which is a north suburb of Chicago, and I picked up the first Muddy Waters record, my first blues record, which was Sail On. It had just come out not too long before that. And I heard Little Walter playing harmonica on there, and I heard all those great songs. And to this day, that's still my favorite record. I mean, it just, it's so formative, but at the same time, I went right to the best stuff.
Yeah.
Muddy Waters was like really the center point of Chicago blues. All these other things developed from him. He really was the guy that created a popularity, and really his songs featured the harmonica as the center point. They were the lead driving force of instrumentally of the songs and helped propel his voice.
Yeah.
Muddy's the man. So that kind of led me on this path.
So you've hosted those Lowdown Blues here on KJZZ for 41 years, since 1984. But one thing I didn't know that came up in another interview I was doing recently was that when you have some of these great acts come through the Rhythm Room, which you've had, you know, for so long, you often will record them yourself. You go to a studio and try to kind of capture a piece of that history, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Well, I found myself in the path of greatness because I knew that when I opened the club, it was going to be the stopover for people who were headed to California. And at that point in time, a lot of the older artists were still around and they were driving around in their vans on tour, headed to the next destination. And so I provided them a stop and I offered them a gig. And then I offered the leader of the band the opportunity to come and do a few songs with me.
Yeah.
And it became a lifestyle, really. I didn't exactly know where they would land or how it would work, but I knew that I had to capture that moment in time because it was this opportunity that I couldn't let pass me by.
Yeah, and some of those recordings are now kind of famous in their own right. Talk a little bit about when you finally decided to release them and to kind of do something with all of these.
Well, I was a little bit shy about putting myself out there because I didn't know my place in all this. These were artists that were greater than I was. But at a point, I compiled a number of the sides, and I didn't want to put anything out because both of my parents had moved to Arizona and they were not in great health. So my dad passed away in 94, my mom in 98. So it wasn't until 1999 that I put out my first record. And when it was on High Tone Records, which was a fairly big record label, and they insisted I call Bob Corritore All-Star Blues Sessions.
Yeah.
I'm like, can I say Bob Corritore's All-Star Blues Session? No, Bob Corritore. So
okay.
I'm like, okay. But I didn't know what to do. I shyly took the mantle, and we put out this record and had Bo Diddley and Jimmy Rogers and Pine Top Perkins and Robert Lockwood and people that were, you know, much more well-known. People reviewed the record and go, this is a really good record, but who the hell is Bob Corritore?
But you were sort of the glue, right? Like you were the one making this all happen.
Yes. And I was the connecting thread because my harmonica embellished each of the tracks in there.
Yeah.
And so that ended up being a template for a lot of records I would put out as Bob Corritore and Friends.
Okay. So let's talk about some of your favorites. What stands out to you over the years?
Oh, there's so many, Lauren. I mean, you're asking the impossible there. But one thing that just came out that was a 2002 session I'm really proud of is a Little Milton piece that he wrote for the session. He was coming to town, and we had been friends for a long time. And finally, we're at a point where he was in between contracts, and he liked the idea of doing a kind of back-to-the-roots session. So I got Henry Gray, an elderly legend of the piano, and Chico Chisholm was on the drums, and we recorded this song, I Want to Be the One.
I want to be the one that made things right for you.
And this remained in my vault until just now. And he passed away 20 years ago.
Right.
But this record was so good, and it kind of just got lost in this pile of amazing stuff I'm going through. And I like, this has to come out. This has to come out.
Another one I know you wanted to talk about was with Francine Reed. Tell us a little bit about this recording.
When I first came into town, Francine Reed was really like the royalty in this town. I used to go see her at a club called The Bosom Tree from the 1980s. And so I always admired her, and we were on the scene together. We were friends. But it wasn't until many years later that I'm like, you know, we've known each other for so long. We really should do some things in the studio together. So we started doing a number of sessions. So this one session I did, I had this song in mind. It was a Memphis Slim song called I Guess I'm a Fool. And it's a kind of a blues ballad. It's a lament, as Francine calls it. And it's just about heartbreak. And it's just one of those very mellow blues songs. And Francine Reed just gave her heart to the song.
You told me you were leaving. After all we've been through, I guess I'm a fool falling in love with you.
And the last one you wanted to highlight today was one by Willie Buck. Tell us about that one.
Willie Buck is special in my life. We just played together just last weekend and recorded together again. But here's a guy that was kind of the neighborhood keeper of the flame of the Muddy Waters sound. So he played in a lot of the Southside clubs. He also had a auto shop, but he'd hire all these great artists. And somehow he got the crazy idea to hire me as his harmonica player. So I show up for work, and not only was Willie Buck there, but all these legendary people. So all of a sudden I was in, you know, I went from being a student to in with the gang.
Yeah.
And I just there was no better feeling than that. So he had been a guest on a number of my Bob Cortorn friends, but we put out a record together, which kind of had to happen. And it's a throwback to the Muddy Waters sound with some original songs and some covers of things that Muddy did.
Whoa, yeah. Someday I just want to love you soon.
It's a good feeling. It's a connection. Willie's 87, soon to be 88, and he's still at it, strong in voice and real motivated. So he never lost the childlike pleasure and drive to participate in the music. And I'm kind of the same way, so we get along just great.
This good thing, my heart, must be made of steel. Out all night, boy. Don't hide, don't miss a tear, but whoa, yeah.
Let me ask you, Bob, about the sort of scope of the blues scene today. I wonder if you think of it as something that is still thriving, or something that needs revival, or something that you're trying to get to the masses, to a new generation. How do you view the sort of arc of blues in America?
Well, blues will always have its place, but a lot of the elders are no longer with us. Mm-hmm. And when they leave us, they leave that sound. So there are people from generations after that that do carry it forward, but you can't get back to the historical part of it, where these were the people that in the 1950s were creating the music and influencing the style and developing it along. So I found it very important to learn the language, and then to try and find my own conversation within that language, but to keep the sound and the basic principles of that sound alive.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Bob Corator, host of Those Lowdown Blues, right here on KJZZ, owner of the Rhythm Room and internationally renowned harmonica player. Bob, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. My pleasure.
You want me to do like Daniel? Sleep in a lion den. I ask the words you're going, boys. Tell me what you've been. Whoa, yeah. Someday I just want to love you soon.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.